105 years old. And that particular element seems to be completely missing from the critical thinking of these individuals. Now, beyond that kind of funny thing, I don't really know why the JFK stuff has seen a resurgence in the last year and a half as related to Donald Trump. And I mean, I'm open to hearing from people why you think that. We've seen all sorts of conspiracy theories relating to Trump, like Trump is truly still the president. The military is still under the control of Donald Trump. There's a shadow government, whatever. Right. OK, fine. But Trump's in his mid 70s, so it's plausible. Why all of a sudden shifting to the would be now 105 year old John F. Kennedy? It doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe it's just things go in cycles and we're back to JFK one way or another. Maybe it'll happen again when JFK would have been 120 years old in 15 years. I don't know. But let me know your thoughts as to why the JFK stuff is such a big deal to so many of these Trump people. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. As many of you know, I will sometimes use the phrase, if all you have is a hammer, right? If all you have is a hammer.
We're doing a class action lawsuit against all machines.
No, I don't know that I would call a hammer a machine. I would call it a tool. If all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you are obsessed with vaccine conspiracy theories, then anytime anything happens to anyone, you point to vaccines. Our old friend Eric from Mass called in about Justin Bieber and Hailey Bieber's recent health troubles. What do you think he blames for them? Take a listen.
Hey, David, it's Eric from Mass. What do you think of Justin Bieber and Hailey Bieber both getting vaccine injured? Paralysis of the face, stroke and a clot to Haley, paralysis of the face for Bieber. It's all listed there. It's from the vaccine. That's a fact. There's no disputing that. Good luck with your kid on the way. That sounds great. Too bad you won't have the same income with the site, and you'll have to find another way. But if you're a resourceful guy, I'm sure you'll be all right.
Yep. No, I'm going to be doing, I don't know how many of you know about Barista Fire. It's quite a movement. And I'm really the real reason I've had my espresso machine is I'm going to be moving into a second job of making coffee very, very soon. OK, so listen, Justin Bieber has been diagnosed with something called Ramsey-Hunt syndrome. It happens with it's basically shingles based. We don't have to go into detail, but it's when a shingles outbreak, shingles is related to chickenpox, right? It's when a shingles outbreak affects the facial nerve. OK, it has nothing to do with the vaccine whatsoever. I don't even know if Justin Bieber's vaccinated, quite frankly. Hailey Bieber, Justin Bieber's wife, did have a small stroke recently. Again, no idea whether she's vaccinated and no evidence whatsoever that it has anything to do with the vaccine. And remember, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When Bob Saget died of blunt force trauma to the head, Candace Owens said, this is a vaccine death, and blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, the autopsy came out and it was not. Sometimes people, you know, I've told the story of my late cousin, Fabian Bielinski, a well-known Argentinian movie director of Nine Queens fame and many other great films. When he was in his mid 40s, he went to Brazil for a production and he had a heart attack and died. And sometimes these things happen. And if you want to just blame everything on vaccines that someone may or may not have received, you certainly can do it. But I prefer to stay in the world of evidence and reality. That's just me. You do you, Eric from Mass. On today's bonus show, I will describe to you the insanity of my last 8 days on planet Earth. Yeah, it's crazy. We will also talk about the massive dumping of the stock market and crypto and the bear market and everything that's going on. Is a recession coming? You know, I don't make predictions, but it's a question people are asking. I don't make predictions. I'm not going to tease that I'm going to predict on the bonus show. Oh, the bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money.
Yeah.
Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
I'm not going to predict that. I'm not going to make any predictions, but I will promise a good time on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. take pleasure in my misery that I will describe to you from the last 8 days of dealing with a newborn. All of that and more when producer Pat joins me.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Jobs are back, but prices are still too high. COVID is down, but gas prices are up. Our work isn't done.
President Biden blames Republicans for blocking his plan to fight inflation in a major address on the economy and labor rights at the AFL-CIO convention in Philadelphia. We'll get an update from longtime labor journalist Stephen Greenhouse at the convention, author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Then, the White House has announced Biden will visit Saudi Arabia next month in a dramatic reversal from Biden's promises on the campaign trail.
And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
But first, we'll speak with journalist Garrett Graff, author of Watergate, A New History.
I'll be talking today about the historical parallels of Richard Nixon's scandal, which marks the 50th anniversary this week of the Watergate burglary on June 17, 1972, and the modern investigation by the U.S. House into the events of January 6th and the differences politically then and now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters went to the polls Tuesday in five states. Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, and South Carolina all held primaries. A special House election also took place in Texas. In South Carolina, five-term Republican Congressmember Tom Rice was soundly defeated in his Republican primary. Rice was one of just 10 Republicans who'd voted to impeach Donald Trump last year after the January 6th insurrection. Another Republican incumbent in South Carolina, Nancy Mace, survived a primary challenge from a Trump-backed candidate. But last year, Mace, though she criticized Trump after the insurrection, later campaigned in the primary on a pro-Trump message. She even recorded a campaign video outside Trump Tower in February. Meanwhile, in Nevada, Republicans who supported Trump's coup attempt won the primaries for Senate and Secretary of State. With his victory in Nevada's Republican Senate primary, Adam Laxalt will now face Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in a race that could determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Laxalt co-chaired Trump's 2020 campaign in Nevada and led efforts to overturn Joe Biden's election win in the state. Meanwhile, Republicans in Nevada picked Jim Marchant to be their candidate for Secretary of State. He's an election denier who was urged to run for office by a prominent backer of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Marchant is leader of an alliance known as America First, which helps backers of Trump's coup attempt to run for top election offices. According to the Washington Post, more than 100 Republicans who backed Trump's election fraud claims have already won primaries this year. In another closely watched race, Republican Myra Flores won a special election for an open House seat in South Texas, which had been held by a Democrat for the past 10 years. Flores, who was born in Mexico and is married to a Border Patrol agent, outspent her closest Democratic rival by a margin of 16 to 1. House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection appears divided on whether the panel should make criminal referrals of Donald Trump or anyone else to the Justice Department. On Monday, the committee's chair, Benny Thompson, said that is not our job. But the committee's vice chair, Republican Liz Cheney, said the committee has not issued a conclusion regarding potential criminal referrals. Another member of the committee, Congressmember Elaine Luria, tweeted, "If criminal activity occurred, it's our responsibility to report that activity to the DOJ," unquote. The committee was scheduled to hold its third public hearing today, but it was postponed. The committee has teased the Thursday hearing by releasing a short video of former White House lawyer Eric Hirschman recalling a conversation he had January 7th, 2021, with John Eastman, the conservative lawyer who helped craft Trump's legal effort to overturn the 2020 election. Attorney Hirschman told the January 6th committee Eastman called him a day after the deadly insurrection to discuss more ways to overturn the election. Hirschman described how the call ended.
"I said to him, are you out of your effing mind? Right? I said, I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth from now on. Orderly transition. Now I'm going to give you the best free legal advice you're ever getting in your life. Get a great effing criminal defense lawyer. You're going to need it." And then I hung up on him.
NATO defense ministers have begun a two-day meeting in Brussels to discuss sending more heavy weapons and missile systems to Ukraine as fighting rages on in eastern Ukraine. On Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called for more arms and anti-missile defense systems to combat Russian attacks. Meanwhile, Pope Francis has condemned what he described as the cruelty of Russian troops in Ukraine. But the Pope also suggested the war had been provoked. He said, quote, "We do not see the whole drama unfold behind this war, which was perhaps somehow either provoked or not prevented," the Pope said. This comes as a Pentagon official has publicly said the Biden administration is not pushing Ukraine to hold talks to end the war. Colin Kahl, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, said, quote, "We're not going to tell the Ukrainians how to negotiate, what to negotiate, and when to negotiate," unquote. Meanwhile, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has posted a message on Telegram suggesting Ukraine will not exist on world maps in 2 years. In related news, some Biden administration officials are now privately expressing concern that Western sanctions on Russia may be backfiring. That's according to a report in Bloomberg, which says the officials fear the sanctions are, quote, exacerbating inflation, worsening food insecurity, and punishing ordinary Russians more than Putin or his allies. The White House has formally announced President Biden will visit Saudi Arabia next month, as well as Israel and the occupied West Bank. Biden's expected to meet with both Saudi King Salman and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. As a candidate, Biden pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah following the brutal assassination of Washington Post Jamal Khashoggi. But the president has taken a different stance in recent months as global gas prices soared. The talks in Saudi Arabia are expected to focus on oil production, the war in Yemen, and other regional issues. Some Democratic lawmakers, including Senator Dick Durbin, are criticizing Biden's decision to travel to Saudi Arabia. This comes as average gas prices in the United States have topped $5 a gallon for the first time ever. The Associated Press is reporting President Biden has just written a letter to U.S. oil refiners calling on them to work with the administration to produce more gasoline and diesel. In the letter, Biden points out oil profits have tripled in a time of war while consumers are facing record prices at the pump. We'll have more on Saudi Arabia and President Biden's decision to meet with Mohammed bin Salman later in the broadcast. The Federal Reserve is expected to issue today its largest interest rate hike since 1994 to combat rising inflation. This comes as the S&P 500 dropped nearly 4% Tuesday. The stock index has fallen by 20% since January. President Biden traveled to Philadelphia Tuesday to address members of the AFL-CIO, blaming Republican lawmakers for blocking his plan to fight inflation. His appearance before the AFL came as union delegates elected Liz Shuler to become the AFL-CIO's first female president and Fred Redmond to be its first African-American secretary-treasurer. We'll have more on Biden's speech and the labor movement later in the broadcast. The European Court of Human Rights blocked Britain from deporting a handful of asylum seekers to Rwanda on Tuesday. The court issued an injunction in the case of an Iraqi national who was on the verge of being flown to Rwanda. Prior to the ruling, a group of activists attempted to stop the deportations by locking themselves together to block a road near the jail where the asylum seekers are being held. None of them are from Rwanda. Indigenous-led protests in Ecuador have intensified after the police arrested Leonidas Ianza, the head of the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, the country's largest indigenous organization. Ianza's arrest Tuesday came a day after he helped launch a nationwide strike to protest Ecuadorian President Guillermo Lasso's economic policies and rising fuel prices. Ianza spoke out on Monday prior to his arrest.
Yes, indeed, we had to resort to resistance because the national government has deepened, or rather continued with the policies of former President Lenin Moreno, putting in place more and more policies of death, which don't allow us to sustain our small economies.
In Brazil, police have arrested a second suspect connected to the disappearance of British journalist Dom Phillips and the Brazilian indigenous expert Bruno Araujo Pereira. The pair went missing over a week ago in one of Brazil's most remote areas of the Amazon. On Tuesday, indigenous activists gathered in Brazil's capital, Brasilia, to demand justice for the missing men.
We are here to defend life. Indigenous people's lives, to defend the environment and claiming for justice for our missing friends. We want answers, and this is why we came here, to the Ministry of Justice.
And the longtime firebrand labor rights activist Charlie Kernaghan has died at the age of 74. He spent decades exposing how corporations sold products made in overseas sweatshops. His investigations exposed the sweatshop practices of numerous companies, including Gap, Microsoft, Disney, Nike, Target, K-Mark, and Levi Strauss. In 1996, Charlie Kernaghan made national headlines when he revealed a clothing line by TV host Kathy Lee Gifford was being made by girls as young as 15 in Honduras who worked up to 70 hours a week for 31 cents an hour. Charlie Kernaghan appeared many times on Democracy Now!
We found documents in a garbage dump for Nike, and it was children's sweatshirts. And the sweatshirt sold for $22.99. This was in the Dominican Republic, and we bought it at Macy's in New York City. Do you know what the workers got paid to make that sweatshirt? 8 cents. So the workers' wages in the Dominican Republic were 0.3% of the retail price. This is what's going on. They're just crushing people and sucking really the blood out of people. 8 cents to make the garment. What would happen if they tripled it to 24 cents? That would be less than 1%. Of the retail price of the garment. In other words, there's plenty of room here, but this is the science of exploitation and misery. And we have to stand up and push back against these corporations.
Again, Charlie Kernaghan has died at the age of 74. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection holds its third hearing on Thursday. Democracy Now! Will bring you live coverage starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We will be live streaming that hearing. On Friday's show, we'll feature highlights from the hearing. This comes as Friday marks the 50th anniversary of the bungled June 17, 1972 break-in, when police answered a call at the Watergate building complex and found five men burglarizing the office of the Democratic National Committee. They've been hired by staff members of the committee to re-elect President Richard Nixon. It was called CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President. This led to an investigation that revealed multiple abuses of power by the Nixon administration and ultimately Nixon's resignation 2 years later. But before Nixon stepped down, the scandal was examined in the Watergate hearings, which lasted 51 days and were broadcast on television with wall-to-wall coverage. Critics called it a television viewing phenomenon. Among those who testified were Nixon's former White House Chief of Staff, John Ehrlichman. Here he's being questioned by Republican Senator Howard Baker.
When did you first learn of the break-in?
On the day following the break-in, when I received this telephone call toward dusk late in the afternoon.
Did you talk to the president on the 17th?
No, I didn't. Not that I can recall.
Did you talk to Mr. Haldeman on the 17th?
I think I talked to him the following day.
Were you concerned about it?
Not particularly.
If someone on my staff, even remotely on my staff, were charged with breaking and entering to the Democratic National Committee headquarters, or someone was even associated with it in a newspaper column, that I would be determined to find out if that happened. Now, was there this air of urgency in the White House on your part or Haldeman's part or Dean's part? It's not coming through that way. It sounds like a routine staff operation, but this wasn't a routine staff operation.
Again, that was the Republican Senator Howard Baker. Just one of the dramatic scenes that played out in the Watergate hearings that followed the Watergate break-in 50 years ago on Friday. For more, we're joined by journalist and author Garrett Graff, who has an op-ed in the New York Times, three critical lessons of the Watergate hearings that the January 6th committee should learn. It draws on his new book, Watergate, A New History. Garrett, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Before we talk about the lessons learned and what today's committee could learn about from the Watergate hearings, which were, shook this country, for those who weren't even born then, can you tell us about what the Watergate scandal was all about? What happened 50 years ago on Friday?
As you said in the introduction, the Friday the 17th marks the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, which in many ways is where America thinks the Watergate story begins. And what my book tries to do is piece together all that we have learned over the last 50 years in terms of new details and newly declassified and released investigative files. And what we now really understand about Watergate was that it was less an event and more a mindset, that that Watergate burglary was the equivalent of America walking into the second or third act of a play that had been underway for years at that point. And that Watergate is really about this dark, criminal, paranoid, conspiratorial mindset that Richard Nixon brings to the White House, that permeates the upper ranks of his administration, that drives the actions of so many aides, including men like John Ehrlichman, who we heard from a moment ago. And that Watergate really becomes an umbrella for about a dozen interrelated but distinct scandals, all of which stem from presidential abuses of power, abuses of American civil liberties, the Nixon administration's attempts to weaponize the government against its political enemies, and that carry straight from the campaign of 1968 through the summer of 74, when Nixon finally resigns from office. So my book and sort of where history, I think, is settling on the Watergate story is to look at the burglary as really just one event in this 6 years of, at least until then, unprecedented corruption and criminality inside the White House.
And Garrett Graff, that actually begins even before Nixon actually becomes president, doesn't it? Talk about the Chenault affair, the Anna Chenault affair, and how that affected even as Nixon was politics in the U.S., even as Nixon was running for president.
Exactly. And this is one of those events that we didn't understand really until the last decade was connected to Watergate at all. And yet we now understand, thanks to newly declassified documents from the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library, that Watergate begins not with the burglary in 72, but with Nixon's campaign for president in the fall of 1968. So remember, fall 68, Nixon, the former vice president, running against the sitting vice president, Hubert Humphrey. Lyndon Johnson, the president, is desperately trying to bring the Vietnam War to a close, convening the Paris peace talks to wind down and find a resolution to the Vietnam War. And Richard Nixon, as a private citizen, presidential candidate, working with his campaign director, John Mitchell, interferes in the Paris peace talks with a woman named Anna Chenault, a Washington socialite. And Anna Chenault sends a message from the Nixon campaign to stall the South Vietnamese government, to tell them that Richard Nixon will give them a better deal as president. And to put a very fine point on this, what we see, what we now understand, is that Richard Nixon kept the Vietnam War going for his own political benefit in the fall of 1968. And kept American servicemen dying in the jungles of Vietnam because he thought it would help him win that election. In the final hours of the campaign, President Johnson discovers this treachery and confronts Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon denies it, and the clock runs out. Effectively, he wins the election before Johnson is able to take action. Johnson decides, for the good of the country, to bury this treachery. These are some of the most serious, most credible allegations approaching outright treason that we have against any political figure in the 20th century. But Johnson decides he can't undermine Nixon's presidency before it begins. But Nixon knows that Johnson knows. And this treachery, this secret, becomes this sort of Edgar Allan Poe telltale heart secret, beating away, eating away at the Nixon presidency, and drives Richard Nixon's overreaction to the Pentagon Papers and eventually the creation of the White House Plumbers Unit that leads to the Dirty Tricks operation in the 72 campaign. And so this is a huge new secret that we're really only understanding in the last decade about where Watergate begins and just how closely linked Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers, and Watergate actually turn out to be.
And I wanted to ask you, though, taking it to the current January 6th hearings, if you could talk, compare the impact of Watergate with these hearings. And I wanted a quote from Chris Hedges, a former New York Times reporter and radical critic, recently wrote that these hearings, he believes, are spectacle replacing politics. And he writes, the committee echoes back to Trump opponents what they already believe. It is designed to present inaction as action and substitute role playing for politics. He actually compares these hearings more to the 1924 Weimar Republic trial of Adolf Hitler for his beer house putsch. That it really is more farce than politics. I'm wondering what your thoughts are, not only about Hedges, but the comparisons between the Watergate hearings and the current hearings, which are much more scripted than Watergate. Watergate was all live give and take, and this is all a lot of it is actually video playings of depositions that are carefully crafted and selected rather than a live give and take.
Yeah, I think part of the challenge is, you know, we don't know yet the full impact of the January 6th hearings. We don't know whether it will lead to action or more inaction. We don't know the evidence that is going to come forward and the political ramifications that are going to unfold. I do think that one of the clearest analogs is this idea of trying to capture that January 6th was not an event as much as a mindset, and that actually, you know, Richard Nixon in Watergate and Donald Trump share this dark criminal conspiratorial mindset that drives and links together so many of their scandals. You know, just as we now understand Watergate as this collection and umbrella of a dozen distinct scandals abuses of power and corruption schemes inside the Nixon administration. I think one of the things that is becoming more clear with the Trump administration is the way that all of the scandals of Donald Trump's presidency are linked, that the Russian attack on the 2016 election, the way it connects to the Mueller investigation, to the Trump's obstruction of justice, to the to that perfect telephone call with Ukraine, to the first impeachment, to the lies around the 2020 election, and eventually the insurrection on January 6th and the second impeachment. That it's really all one story stemming from the paranoid and criminal and conspiratorial mind of Donald Trump.
So, Garrett Graff, I wanted to go back again, because when you talk about the dark and conspiratorial mind of Nixon, it is really incomprehensible why, for example, a year before the Watergate break-in, in June of 1971, Dan Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. Nixon went crazy over these. But in no way did it implicate him. I mean, it implicated his enemies, Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. It was a secret history of the war in Vietnam. Nixon, at that point, was not a part of that. Explain why he then went off on that and everything else that ensued.
Yeah. Well, and this has long been one of the great mysteries, which is, you are absolutely right, there are 2 million words in the Pentagon Papers, and not a single one of them is Nixon. These should have been one of the great political coups of his life. I mean, his two mortal enemies, JFK and LBJ, are slammed in these papers, and Nixon is not mentioned at all. However, the key that we now understand that has been unlocked in the last couple of years that sort of gives us our understanding for the first time of Nixon's overreaction to the Pentagon Papers is this Chenault affair, which is that Nixon becomes afraid in the wake of the Ellsberg release of the Pentagon Papers in June 1971, that as part of these leaks, that the documents documenting the Chenault affair will come out. He knows these documents exist. He doesn't know where they are. He comes to think that they're actually at the Brookings Institution, the think tank in Washington. And so he is on tape in the summer of 1971, ordering the only burglary that he's actually on the White House tapes ordering, which isn't of the Watergate in 72, but is of Brookings in 1971. And the White House, with G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, the sort of over-eager plumbers who go on to become the masterminds, quote-unquote, of the Watergate burglary a year later, they come up with this fantastical, wild criminal plan to firebomb the Brookings Institution and bring in the same team of Cuban burglars that they use a year later in Watergate, and dress them up as DC firefighters, equip them with a secondhand DC fire truck, and have them respond to the firebombing at Brookings, and in the chaos of the firefighting, break into Brookings, break into its safe, and steal back the Chenault papers to keep Nixon's treason and treachery secret. And the White House decides to abandon the plan, not because this is sort of wild and awful and criminal, but because they turn out to be too cheap to buy the fire truck. And that over the course of multiple days in the wake of the Pentagon Papers release, Nixon is storming in the Oval Office, repeatedly ordering this burglary and asking why it hasn't been carried out. And what it amounts to is the creation of the Plumbers Unit, which then goes on to break into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in the fall of 1971, one of the sort of related scandals that comes out later in Watergate and actually is the reason that the charges are ultimately dropped against Daniel Ellsberg, as you know. And that it sort of creates this unit with an overeager imagination and a sort of criminal rambunctiousness to punish Richard Nixon's enemies inside the White House.
So I just want to ask, why was Nixon ultimately the biggest deal was this burglary of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, inside Watergate? Why was it all about that and not the illegal bombing of Cambodia, or why the whole issue of Johnson, you know, understanding clearly Nixon had prolonged the war, the deaths of so many Vietnamese, but he was concerned about U.S. soldiers so he could get elected?
Yeah. And this is where, you know, it's fascinating to go back and look at all of these events 50 years later, because the Watergate that has been handed down to us in popular culture and history, you know, movies like All the President's Men with Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman turn out to capture a very small slice of the overall story. And much of it has only become clear with the passage of time. And that was really the goal of my book, to try to retell the full story of Watergate, start to finish, soup to nuts, because what becomes clear is that the guiding adage that we think is true out of Watergate, you know, the cover-up is always worse than the crime, which you hear in basically every modern political scandal, turns out not to be true in Watergate, that Richard Nixon's crimes were many and quite terrible and serious abuses of power.
And Gary Graff, you note in your recent New York Times piece that the third lesson from the Watergate Committee, quote, underscores the vast gulf politically between 1973 and 2022, especially the role of the Republicans on the committee and in Congress more generally, who back then were good faith participants. Could you talk about that comparison to the current hearings?
Yeah, and you played a little bit of this talking with a quote from Howard Baker in the introduction as he's interrogating John Ehrlichman. What really stands out then and now, you know, obviously the Watergate my book is a story of 50 years ago, and it's about Richard Nixon's crimes and corruption. But Donald Trump looms over every page of this book on Watergate. You know, the parallels and the challenges to our country and our democratic system really ring across a half century of American politics here. But the biggest difference I think you see between then and now is the behavior of the Republican Party, that Watergate is a story of a criminal president, but it's also, I think, a very hopeful story about how American democracy works and how our system can protect democracy. And you see the delicate ballet and role that every institution in American government and life had to play to bring Richard Nixon to justice in 1974. You know, the press, the FBI, the Justice Department, the House, the Senate, the District Court, the Appeals Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. And when you compare that to the modern times, most of the rest of the system did its role. The media did the investigations that they were supposed to. The FBI, the Justice Department did what they were supposed to. And where holding President Trump to account fell apart was in the House and in the Senate. And where it fell apart was in the behavior of the Republicans, specifically in Congress. That in Watergate, you saw the Republican members of Congress understand that they had an important prerogative as members of the legislative branch to hold the co-equal executive branch to account, to keep its abuses of power in check. And that they had a role as legislators first and only as partisan Republicans second. And that was true across the Republican spectrum in 1972, 73, and 74. You know, you saw moderates like Lowell Weicker. You saw, you know, sort of solid Republicans like Howard Baker. And you saw, you know, even the conservative standard bearer, Barry Goldwater, all play important roles in bringing Richard Nixon to justice, because they understood that protecting American democracy meant making sure that the executive branch didn't run out of control. And what we see now is Republicans in Congress acting as partisans first and members of Congress second, if at all. And in fact, the number of people who the number of Republicans who have acted to hold the presidency to account is short and getting shorter. Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger on the January 6th committee, we saw last night one of the very few Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump in the House lose his primary. This is a pretty dark time for the behavior of the Republican Party.
Very quickly, how did Nixon go down? What, as you say, Trump, sort of infuses this whole book when you look at the parallels. But you have Trump perhaps about to announce for again running for the presidency. But then you have Nixon going down. He wasn't impeached. He resigned.
Yes. And what you saw, remember those Watergate hearings in the summer of 73, it takes a full additional year for the scandal to play out. And you see the accumulation of Nixon's lies, the accumulation of the evidence of the cover up becomes inescapable. Following the Saturday night massacre, his abuse of power in enforcing the resignation of the leadership of the Justice Department, the firing of the special prosecutor investigating him, weighs on the Republicans in the Senate and in the House. And they decide by the spring of 74 that basically Nixon is unsavable, and particularly in the wake of the Supreme Court decision that forces him to release the White House tapes that show his participation in the burglary cover-up, which he had long denied, the Republican Party made a decision to abandon him.
Garrett Graff, we want to thank you for being with us, journalist, historian, author of several books. His latest, Watergate, A New History, and we'll link to your piece in the New York Times, headlined Three Critical Lessons of the Watergate Hearings That the January 6th Committee Should Learn. Next up, President Biden addresses the AFL-CIO convention as delegates elect their first woman president and first African-American secretary treasurer. Stay with us. The Garden Path by Kamasi Washington. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden addressed the economy and labor rights Tuesday in a speech to thousands of members of the AFL-CIO at their convention in Philadelphia and laid out his plans to tackle the worst inflation the United States has experienced in decades.
The problem is Republicans in Congress are doing everything they can to stop my plans to bring down costs on ordinary families. That's why my plan is not finished and why the results aren't finished either. Jobs are back, but prices are still too high. COVID is down, but gas prices are up. Our work isn't done.
Biden addressed the AFL-CIO, the country's largest federation of labor unions, just days after delegates elected Liz Shuler as their first woman president and Fred Redmond to be their first African-American secretary treasurer. This comes as President Biden's expressed support for unions and used his speech to call on voters to elect candidates who back workers and labor rights, including John Fetterman, Democratic Senate candidate in Pennsylvania, and Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, who is there. Biden's also met with Amazon and Starbucks union leaders at the White House, as both corporations face accusations of illegally firing and retaliating against unionizing workers. For more, we go to Philadelphia to speak with Stephen Greenhouse, longtime labor journalist who was at the AFL-CIO's convention when Biden spoke, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, former New York Times reporter, author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of where President Biden addressed the catastrophe of the economy right now in some ways because of inflation, though jobs are a different story, and all sorts of issues from the bear market on, and what people on the floor were saying, the thousands of union activists.
So Biden very much felt that, you know, he's under a lot of criticism because of what's happening with the economy, especially inflation. And he knows that for the Democrats to do well this November, they really have to win over a lot of blue collar voters, not just in the Midwest, but in the rest of the country. So his message was, first, I'm fighting for you. I'm fighting for workers. I'm fighting for unions. I'm a pro-union president. I passed this big infrastructure bill that will create hundreds of thousands of good middle-class jobs. I want to do more on child care. I want to do more on student debt. The American Rescue Plan, helped tens of millions of American families. I've created 8.6 million jobs as president, more than any other president in such a short time. The unemployment rate is down to 3.6%, which is very, very low. So he really said, I'm doing well on the economy, except we have this inflation problem. Second, he was really putting forward a kind of blue-collar message. He was really hitting corporations very hard, saying, the big corporations, the billionaires, are not paying their fair share, and that, the billionaires are paying just 8% of income in income taxes, which is higher than the average school teacher and steel worker. And he got huge applause. And this was one of the best speeches I've seen Biden give. He was really very vigorous, and he got a large, big standing ovation. And I interviewed one union president afterwards who said, what we as a nation need, what the Democrats need, is for more Democrats to sound just like Biden did today.
So, Steve, how do you deal with this this quandary that, on the one hand, unemployment is as low as it's been in decades, wages have increased substantially, employers can't find enough workers, and yet there is such disaffection in terms of the masses of the people, especially over inflation and the rising price of gasoline. And President Biden is seen as really his heart is in the right place, but his effectiveness is the problem. I'm wondering how you see it in terms of labor, because he didn't really announce any new initiatives by the administration to the AFL-CIO.
Juan, that's a great question. The one that Democrats are really, trying to figure out, that Biden is trying to figure out. They have in many ways done a great job on the economy. I spoke to some top labor leaders. Lee Saunders, head of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, detailer, president of the Hotel Workers Union. They both say the Democrats are not doing a good enough job in getting the message across that they're fighting for the average workers, that Republicans are blocking them on many things like, trying to enact, greater subsidies for child care. And that, he does have this inflation problem, and it's very hard. But, I think he has to do a better job, and it's extremely hard to do, to say the inflation problem is really not our fault. It's mainly the fault of, the Ukrainian war, which is pushing up gas prices and food prices. It's the supply chain problems created by the pandemic. And, Republicans are doing a great job saying, oh, it's all Joe Biden's fault. And Joe Biden and the Democrats aren't doing a good enough job saying it's not our fault. It's due to problems beyond us. But, a problem all presidents face is the buck stops here. And if inflation is high on your watch, you're going to people are going to blame you. So that's why Biden has to do a much better job showing America's voters, America's workers, that I am fighting for you, and that, you know, I am trying to lower inflation, and I have done a great job creating these 8.6 million jobs and lowering the inflation rate, lowering the unemployment rate. And he has to make clear that except for inflation, the economy is really doing quite well, that the rebound from the pandemic, from the recession, has been very rapid. It's a hard message, but they really have to hammer it and hammer it and hammer it.
And I want to ask you about the changing climate, especially among young people in the United States, regarding unions. We've covered here on this show many of the successes of over 150 Starbucks retail stores have unionized. But the Starbucks stores, although there are many of them, they're small numbers of workers. That one Amazon plant in Staten Island that unionized 8,000 workers, that's more than double what probably all the Starbucks union campaigns have succeeded in recruiting to the labor movement so far. I'm wondering your sense of how the AFL-CIO and the new president is going to deal with the issue of organizing on a massive scale, given the fact that so many young people now are predisposed to unions.
I just finished a big story on that for The Guardian. So, you know, on one hand, you know, the Starbucks unionization drive and the Amazon victory in Staten Island, they're, in many ways, as Amy and Juan, you know, have been like the two biggest, most inspiring unionization efforts in decades. And it's really, they've really jazzed, you know, millions of young workers about unions. And, you know, this recent study I saw said 74%, 3 out of 4 young workers aged 18 to 24 say they would vote to join a union if they could. So young workers are really jazzed about unions. We're seeing it not just at Starbucks and Amazon, but at REI and Google Fiber and Amazon, and at, you know, museum workers and work, you know, undergraduate workers at Dartmouth and Grinnell and Wesleyan and Hamilton have unionized. So there's huge excitement among young workers to unionize. And, you know, so coming into this AFL-CIO convention here in Philadelphia, there was a lot of pressure, a lot of questions facing the AFL-CIO that, are you going to step up to the moment? Are you, as the nation's big established labor federation, going to do anything to really push, help this youth-fueled unionization movement grow? So Liz Shuler, who was elected to a full 4-year term as AFL-CIO president after succeeding Richard Trumker, her predecessor, when he died of a heart attack in August, Liz Shuler announced what she says is a bold plan, that the AFL is going to set out to, the AFL's 57 unions are setting a goal of unionizing an additional 1 million workers over 10 years. And she says, that's great. This is the first time we're creating measurable goals for unions to increase their membership. And 1 million over 10 years really translates to a 1% increase in union membership per year. Now, some people say that after unions have lost members year after year, it's a real substantial goal to try to increase membership by 1% a year. But I spoke to some well-known union leaders, you know, detailer of the hotel workers, Sarah Nelson of the flight attendants, Mark Damenstein of the postal workers union, saying 1%, that the 1 million goal is just not enough, that this is a really a moment when millions of workers are really inspired about unions. They're jazzed up. They're eager to unionize. So that, you know, they're criticizing this 1 million goal as falling far short. They say that the AFL has to be far bolder. And some union leaders I spoke to here say it's weird, it's disappointing that among the hundreds of speakers at the AFL-CIO convention, there were no Starbucks workers and no one from the Amazon labor union, which won in Staten Island. And it's no coincidence that, you know, those unions, the Amazon Labor Union and Independent Union and the Starbucks workers, you know, who are joining Workers United, which is part of the SEIU. The SEIU is not part of the AFL-CIO. So workers from those non-AFL-CIO unions have not been invited to this big convention. And some people say, we talk about labor solidarity, we talk about pulling all together. So why is it that workers from some of the most exciting unionization drives in decades are not invited to speak at this convention?
Why is it? And finally, Stephen Greenhouse, you talk about this being the John Lewis moment for unions. What do you mean by that?
So John L. Lewis was the president of United Mine Workers in the 1930s, when that was the richest, biggest, most powerful union in the nation. In the 1930s, there was the beginning of unionization of mass production industries. Henry Ford really began huge mass production lines. And in the 1930s, there was this effort among steelworkers and auto workers to unionize. But the American Federation of Labor at the time really didn't want to help these people unionize. The American Federation of Labor were a bunch of craft unions, carpenters, bricklayers, and they thought, we don't want to help this mass unionization by this group they saw as largely unskilled workers. And John Lewis said, these folks, these mass production workers, are the future of the labor movement. We're crazy if we don't help them unionize. So John Lewis, backed by some other unions, the textile workers, the garment workers, got behind, funded this effort to unionize these mass production workers, thanks to the big treasury of the mine workers. They hired 500 organizers to organize auto workers and machinery workers and steel workers, and that produced the biggest surge in unionization in American history. The nation went from 12% of the workforce being unionized in 1935 to basically, over 30% unionized in 1946-47. And that was thanks to the efforts of John Lewis and the so-called Congress of Industrial Organizations. So they met the moment. They stepped up. And the theme of this AFL-CIO meeting now is, building a movement to meet the moment. And some people are questioning whether the AFL-CIO's goal of unionizing 1 million over 10 years really meets the moment. They're saying that the Federation should do more. Liz Schuler, who's very much a consensus leader, she says, the 57 unions of the AFL, this is what we could get them to agree to. And some people say this is lowest common denominator unionism. Liz Schuler and the Federation should do more to push unions to do more. And Schuler's kind of saying, after years of losing membership, it's a ambitious goal even to do 1 million over 10 years. So there's a real tug of war. I see many unions, many labor academics, many labor activists are saying, look, 1 million, organizing 1 million over 10 years just ain't enough. And they're pushing, pulling the AFL-CIO, the nation's unions, to do a lot more.
Stephen,
and there will be
10 seconds.
Workers in SAU that will continue doing a lot of unionization. Sorry.
Stephen Greenhouse, thanks so much for being with us. Longtime labor journalist, senior fellow at Santry Foundation, his book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Next up, President Biden, when he was running for president, said that Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman should be pariahs. He has reversed himself. We'll bring you more. 30 seconds. In the Shadow of Life by Niaz. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The White House has formally announced President Biden will visit Saudi Arabia next month, as well as Israel and the occupied West Bank. Biden's expected to meet with both Saudi King Salman and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. As a candidate in the campaign trail, Biden pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah following the brutal assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi.
And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
But Biden has taken a different stance in recent months as global gas prices soared. His talks in Saudi Arabia are expected to focus on oil production, the war in Yemen, and other regional issues. For more, we're joined by Sarah Lee Whitson, lawyer for Khashoggi's fiancé, in a lawsuit against the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for Khashoggi's murder, his dismemberment in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. She's executive director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, which Jamal Khashoggi founded. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We only have 5 minutes, Sarah Lee, but I'm wondering if you can respond to this just complete reversal of President Biden from saying they're pariahs to going to meet with them.
It's a very dramatic capitulation to a very clear red line that President Biden had announced, perhaps off the cuff. But I think it is in response to a massive amount of pressure from the defense industry lobbies, from the Israeli, Saudi, and Emirati lobbies, and the confluence of the war in Ukraine that has driven up oil prices, all of which have resulted in pressuring President Biden to do what he clearly didn't want to do, which is go and kiss the ring of Mohammed bin Salman. I also want to note that the notion of whether or not Biden is going to meet with Mohammed bin Salman is a bit of a red herring, because the real concession here, what the Saudis and Emiratis have been demanding in order to continue to purchase American weapons, is a security agreement, a defense agreement that will commit U.S. troops to defending the Saudi and Emirati monarchies. That is what President Biden is going to deliver in Riyadh. That is what we should all be very worried about.
And what about the continuing massive weapon sales under the Biden administration, not only to the Saudi Arabia, but to Jordan, the United Arab Emirates as well?
Well, I mean, the truth is in the pudding. Despite the promise from President Biden that you just heard that he would end weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, it was very clear from the beginning of the administration that that was not going to happen. Saudi Arabia is America's largest weapons client. It is the largest weapons client in the world. And number two behind it is the UAE. Everybody knows what the right thing to do is, and that is to end weapon sales to these heinous governments, given their atrocious war crimes for 6 years in Yemen. But ultimately, the Biden administration has succumbed to the pressures of defense industries and the foreign government lobbyists to continue what are very profitable arms sales for the defense industry. Certainly, this doesn't suit or serve the interests of the American people, but it very much serves the interests of major donors to the Democratic Party, major donors to the Biden administration, and that is the lobbyists that represent the defense industries and the foreign governments.
I was watching John Kirby, the spokesperson for the Pentagon, questioned about whether he'll raise human rights. And he said, well, he does do that kind of thing. We kind of expect he will. But what about, for example, is there pressure being brought to end your lawsuit on behalf of Khashoggi's fiance for the dismemberment of Khashoggi, the murder of Khashoggi? And we're not only talking about one man here. Also, the dismemberment of Yemen, the atrocity that is one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world, with U.S. weapons-backed Saudi Arabia bombing of Yemen.
Well, just to be clear, the lawsuit is a lawsuit that Dawn has brought in its own capacity, and Khadija Jengiz, Jamal's widow, is our co-plaintiff. We are jointly together in this lawsuit for the murder and torture of Jamal Khashoggi. And we know that Mohammed bin Salman has demanded that the Biden administration interfere in our lawsuit to grant him immunity. That's not going to happen. It hasn't happened so far. But if he ascends to become king, he will have sovereign immunity. The other defendants in the lawsuit will remain, and we are waiting for a verdict from the court on their motion to dismiss our lawsuit. We intend to prevail. We hope we will prevail. I should note that today we will be commemorating the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by Mohammed bin Salman by unveiling a new street sign in front of the Saudi embassy at 1 p.m. That, I think, is the most important act of commemoration and accountability that exists to date, a permanent street sign in front of the Saudi embassy, reminding them and reminding the whole world who was responsible for this heinous crime. Very happy to see a truce in Yemen, but let's face it, this is a face-saving exit for the Saudi government from their catastrophic, futile war that has caused nothing but destruction and brought zero gain, even for the Saudis' nefarious plot to contain and control Yemen.
So the Saudi Arabian embassy will be on Jamal Khashoggi Way?
That's right. The new address of the Saudi embassy, and we hope Google will adjust its maps to reflect that, is officially now Jamal Khashoggi Way. That is designated by the Washington, D.C. City Council, which unanimously approved
3 seconds.
Our efforts to redesignate the street. And we hope you all watch the unveiling of the street sign today at 1 p.m.
Sarah Lee Whitson, we want to thank you for being with us of dawn. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. The new movie Dream Horse tells a true story that takes place in a tiny Welsh village. On a whim, the local bartender, played by Toni Collette, dreams of breeding a championship racehorse. So she buys a mare and she persuades her neighbors to chip in with a little money each week to support her efforts. Now, a horse like that is a long shot to win anything, but you can imagine why there's a movie about this true story. So,
'cause they lose, right?
Well, Grant, you'll just have to see it. It's pretty predictable, but if you do see this movie, you may wonder about a word that turns up when the local townsfolk meet for the first time to decide whether to go for this seemingly impossible goal. Eventually, they all agree that they're not doing this for any prize money. They're doing it for the hoyle. And if you go to look up the word hoyle in the dictionary, you may have trouble finding it. But here's the key. Here's what you have to remember. This story takes place in Wales, and the word they're using is spelled H-W-Y-L, hoyle.
Nice. W is a vowel.
W as a vowel, as you see in Welsh. The term is hard to define, but I looked it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, and the definition there was an emotional quality which inspires and sustains impassioned eloquence. Also, the fervor of emotion characteristic of gatherings of Welsh people. Grant, I can't wait to go to Wales. I want to experience hoyle.
Oh, that's lovely. I want to watch that movie. I saw a trailer for it. I'm like, yeah, it looks predictable, but I like a bunch of the actors in it. The scenery looked great. I like horses. I love Toni Collette. Sure.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Damian Lewis. Damian Lewis is easy on the eyes.
Sure,
well, one more bit of good news about this word is that I checked. You can use it in Scrabble. H-W-Y-L. Hoyle in Welsh.
And a great word when people say, well, what about W? Is it a vowel? And you're like, yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the hoyle to prove it. We're not the only ones that find words everywhere we go, everywhere we look, everywhere we read, everywhere we listen. What have you found? Share it with us on Twitter at WAYWORD. Words at waywardradio.org, or, of course, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, how are you? My name is Peter. I'm calling from lovely Cranford, New Jersey.
Welcome to the show, Peter. What's up?
I have a question about idiomatic expressions, specifically idiomatic expressions in the United States and England. You know, George Bernard Shaw said that the United States and Great Britain are two countries separated by a common language, and I got to live there, for a little less than a year back in the 1980s. And so some things are, you know, some words are like everyone knows that chips mean French fries and lift is elevator. But then you get to things like gobsmacked and who knows what that means, or Bob your uncle. But particularly, here's my question. We say in this country, not by a long shot. And there, they say not by a long chalk. Now, I assume they mean the same thing, but I haven't a clue why there's a difference in why shot and chalk.
Where did you encounter not by a long chalk?
Well, you would say to somebody, you know,